This is Culturetopia, your weekly dose of culture love from your friends at National Public Radio. I am Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Sonari Glenton, a producer for All Things Considered.
We want to remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia.
This week, we take a look at the take-no-prisoners world of English soccer in the new film, The Damned United.
And we'll have a conversation with musician Roseanne Cash about a new album of songs her father, who happens to be Johnny Cash, recommended to her as a young musician.
But first,
most likely, you've come across Jane Lynch, a character actress, 6 feet tall, short blonde hair, and she cracks me up whenever I see her face. She's been in countless TV series and in tons of movies. She was the poodle handler in the Christopher Guest mockumentary Best in Show and the sexually frustrated store manager in The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
I'm very discreet, but I'll haunt your dreams.
In her new musical series Glee on Fox, Jane Lynch plays a scheming cheerleader coach, here giving advice to an idealistic young teacher who wants to start a glee club at the school.
Let's break it down. You want to be creative. You want to be in the spotlight. Face it, you want to be me. So here's the deal. You do with your depressing little group of kids what I did with my wealthy, elderly mother. Euthanize it. It's time. And I'll be happy to offer you a job as my second assistant on Cheerios. You can fetch me Gatorade and launder my soiled delicates. It'll be very rewarding work for you.
NPR's Melissa Block asked Lynch how she describes her character.
Power-hungry, ruthless, cruel, delicious, self-confident. This woman has no inner doubt. She doesn't have much reflection going on.
And she has what seems to be an endless supply of Adidas tracksuits.
Yes, indeed. And they get Nike as we move on. Because Fox is big with Nike, so we kind of share the Nike Adidas thing. And
oh,
then
I see.
By the end of the, I have about 14 tracksuits in different colors. As you've seen, I've got a hot pink one. We're going to see a neon green and gray that'll be coming up in a few episodes. It's like slipping into your pajamas when you go to work. I love it.
Well, Sue Sylvester gets a regular slot on the local TV station. It's called Sue's Corner. This feeds into her sense of glory.
Mm-hmm.
She is in one episode a strong defender of caning.
Yes, indeed. Well, it works. Look at the spotless streets of Singapore.
Yes, we cane.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we cane. She's also a great advocate of littering.
Yeah, let's play this scene. The station executive is bringing in a big, pretty hefty wad of hate mail. She's done a commentary in favor of littering, and here's how she defends herself.
Well, Mr. McClung, your station didn't hire me because I was yellow. And not everyone's going to have the walnuts to take a pro-littering stance, but I will not rest until every inch of our fair state is covered in garbage. That's why I pay taxes. It keeps garbage men earning a living so they can afford tacos for their family.
What a sweetheart.
You just want to take her home.
Yeah, you do. Everybody needs a nice Sue Sylvester in their home.
Do you ever find you start thinking like her, that you know, if something comes up and you flip into Sue Sylvester mode in real
Melissa,
life?
She's not far from the surface, let me tell you. I don't have to dig very deep to find that contemptuous strain in myself. I just, you know, I want to live in this society and I want to present well, but so I keep that under wraps. But boy, when I put on that tracksuit, it comes out.
Well, you do. You chew on these one-liners like they're just a tasty snack. Here's one of my favorites.
I'd love to stay and chat, but I got a satellite interview. That's lingo again. For an interview, be a satellite.
You know, I don't improvise very much in the show, but I did make that one up.
You made that one up?
Yes, I made that one up. I will claim the ones I made up.
When you think about the projects you've done and you've bounced around from so many shows to movies and back, is it strange for you, first of all, to find yourself doing something that has such staying power that you're filming so many episodes for?
Yeah. You know, I wanted to do something where I could hang my hat. The nature of the work I've done lately has been, you know, 3 or 4 days here, there, and I travel a lot. I haven't had a character arc. I've basically just had scenes here and there. And so when I got the opportunity to do Glee, I was absolutely thrilled. You know, and they've given me a life. They've given me a backstory. The character gets affected by things. And, of course, she doesn't change very much.
We don't want her to evolve.
No. There will be no changing and evolving or growing. thing. There will not be a lot of hugs given at any point from Sue Sylvester. But it's really fun to come to the same place to work every day. I brought a pillow and I have a candle in my trailer and, you know, a blow dryer and a little coffee maker. It's really nice to set up shop somewhere.
So, Netta, if you are going to see only one rapper this year who happens to be white, Muslim, albino, and legally blind, it should be Brother Ali. He's on a national tour right now, but he started off as a kid from the Midwest named, I already missed his name.
Jason Newman.
Jason Newman. Now, a warning, this piece has some language that some listeners may find offensive. Here's Netta with the story.
You know, a kid like me from the Midwest was so enthralled by the poetry and artistry of people like Rakim that it made me want to know, what is he talking about?
Rakim, one of the all-time greatest MCs, produced classics like Move the Crowd.
He said, all praise due to Allah, and that's a blessing. I wanted to know what that was. And so when Chuck D and KRS-One were saying things like, Farrakhan's a prophet, I think you ought to listen to, that initially is what made me track down the Quran.
Brother Ali converted at the age of 15. He followed Imam W. Din Muhammad, who moved the Nation of Islam away from black nationalism and towards a more conventional global Muslim identity. Muhammad was forward-thinking, a champion of interfaith relations.
When I was a kid, there was a group of people that he sent to Malaysia to study the way that a more kind of liberal Islamic society could have this peaceful coexistence between different religions. And I was one of the people that he picked to go over there and study.
Shukran, Brother Ali. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
Hip-hop and Islam tend to get caught up in the same misconceptions, says Brother Ali, that they're somehow inherently violent, disrespectful of women, homophobic. Ali says these attitudes are much bigger than either hip-hop or Islam.
They come from weaknesses and insecurity within human beings.
Weaknesses and insecurities Ali has faced himself.
In my old work, I was so ignorant to the hell that gay people are put through because they're deemed to be different. I would say, well, I said the word faggot on my first album. And I'm so thoroughly embarrassed by that now that I have gay friends and gay people that I look up to.
He has girlfriends but doesn't want a girlfriend. He retreats inside himself where he lives life itself in secret. Daddy says people go to hell for being what he is, and he certainly believes him. Cause there ain't no flame that can blaze enough to trump being hated for the way you love. And cry yourself to sleep and hate waking up. It's a cruel world, y'all, shame on us.
You never quite know what's coming on any given Brother Ali track. The first single from his new album is about domestic ecstasy, his intense satisfaction being home with his wife and kids.
Just got married last year, treated so good that it ain't even fair. Already got a boy, now the baby girl's here. Bought us a house like the Bernstein Bears. Not 2 years ago, I was homeless. I mean, crashing on the couch of my homies. Now I'm crashing on the couch with Conan. Signed a mortgage.
In every album, I try to talk about a lot of important things to me that are good, and I try to come from a really sincere, genuine place within myself, but I'd be lying if I didn't include at least one song where I'm just an
In the new album, that might be the song that's a fantasy about getting even with an obnoxious neighbor by stealing and selling his drugs. When he rhymes about dealing drugs before his conversion, it's about the excruciating boredom of standing on a corner for hours, not the supposed glamour of thug life. In the same way, it's mundane details like crashing on the couch with his kids that fill Brother Ali with an uncompromising, uncorny integrity.
Truth is here, the truth is here. Truth is here, the truth is here. I said the truth is here, the truth is here. I want more. Give me more. We want more.
Ali's language is not always so squeaky clean. He curses a lot, and that's drawn disapproval from more orthodox Muslims. But the musician says he can express his faith even with what he calls his grown-up words.
Everything in Islam is an act of worship. Everything good and pure and genuine that you do is an act of worship. I believe that me being the best artist that I can be translates to me being the most honest artist that I can be. Were I not to show the crass side of myself, I'd be holding something back from my artistry.
Gotta let it out at least enough to let the monster flee. I want more than what you offering me. Songs that make me feel like I'm already free. I'm a rebel in my own right. Y'all don't want to write or think or speak a rhyme standing next to me.
Brother Ali says his music reflects his progress on a spiritual journey. And maybe he's still growing into his faith. Right now, Ali is on a strenuous physical journey as well. His current tour across the United States takes him to almost 50 cities in the next month and a half. Neto Ulibi, NPR News. Give me more. I
want more. So, Neto, there's a new feature film called The Damn United, and it's about the bloody, bruising, take-no-prisoners world of English soccer in the early 60s and 70s. It's about manager Brian Clough, who leads his terrible footballers out of the basement to become the champions of England, and then he goes on to become the head of Leeds United, which is one of the best teams in England ever. Miss Melissa Block has had a banner week on our podcast. She's got another one. And she spoke with film director Tom Hopper about Clough and the reputation the Leeds team has on the soccer field.
Its reputation was that it was a dirty side. It was a side that was very physical, was violent. When the referee wasn't looking, would do things to intimidate the other players. But, you know, that aside, for Brian Clough on his first day of work to basically say to, you know, the top side in the country who've won all the awards, all the medals, that they should throw them all away because they're a bunch of cheats, is an incredibly bold move. It would be like me working with an Oscar-winning actress and on first day of work saying, well, you can basically throw your Oscar in the bin, but as far as I'm concerned, you just got lucky and, you know, you've never acted well until you've worked with me. And it would not be an astute way to approach it.
Let's talk a bit about this outsized reputation of Brian Clough, at least in his own mind. You, in the movie, include actual footage of Muhammad Ali, who has heard, I gather, that Brian Clough is being called another Muhammad Ali. And Brian Clough is watching him talk about this on television. Let's take a listen.
Some fella in London, England, named some Brian Clough. I heard all the way in America that this fella talks too much. They say he's another Muhammad Ali. There's just one Muhammad Ali. Now, Clough, I've had enough. Stop it.
Clough, I've had enough. What's the story there?
Oh, it's an absolute gift. I mean, because, you know, we like to think of Brian Clough as our answer to Muhammad Ali because he's a maverick, because he's outspoken, because he's unpredictable, because he's a fighter, because he's driven. Even though he's a soccer coach, you know, as a player, he was the fastest goal scorer in British footballing history at the time, and he went on to have this pugnacious, unpredictable reputation. So to have found footage where actually Muhammad Ali accuses him of being another Muhammad Ali really reveals how iconic Clough had become in English culture. And I think it's because he transcended football and became a personality who would do all the chat shows and was kind of the first sports personality to become a celebrity and use his celebrity status to leverage his position as a sports personality.
The physical aspect of soccer back then, you know, you have, I think, both archive footage and footage that you shot of what these games were like. And it's like mud wrestling out there. It's just a free-for-all.
Yeah, and the game has changed so much. And what's fun about the film is it's a record of, I suppose, a vanished world of how football used to be before this incredible influx of Murdoch's money transfigured the game in the UK, and it's now become a much more, you know, it used to be an absolute working class game rooted in its communities, as you can see in our movie, and it's now become gentrified, and I wanted to take it back to this sort of decrepit, impoverished, underfunded beginning when people at the time were predicting the demise of football within 20 years. Mm.
You can hear Melissa's full interview with Tom Hopper at npr.org/culturetopia.
For his new book, Searching for Whitopia, Rich Benjamin lists every city and country in the U.S. that is, quote, whiter than the nation, its respective region, and its state. He calls these enclaves Whitopias. Once Benjamin identified the Whitopias, he immersed himself in them. He wanted to find out why more and more whites are moving to small towns and exurban areas that are, for the most part, white. Benjamin spoke with Neil Conan and says he found these places to be really nice.
Yes, they are nice in certain ways. They look beautiful. There is a neighborliness to them. The real estate is gorgeous. But that's one part of nice that I describe. There is a lingering or simmering social tension in many of them, regarding the political issues of the day.
And uniformly nice, yet there is that underlying tension. You describe these people, the new ones who've moved in, as refugees of diversity.
Yes, and some of them describe themselves that way. I remember going to a meeting there, and a woman said, well, I've left California, I've left Arizona, and now that, quote-unquote, illegal immigration is coming to Utah, you guys will have a taste of why I left. And so they're sort of anticipating a negative future, and that's why some of them are in Utah's Dixie, is because, you know, they're worried about what diversity and immigration specifically have done to places like Southern California or Arizona.
And the places they are largely leaving from. And you point out that at the same time America is becoming less and less white, these communities are becoming more and more white.
In some cases, yes. In America, as we know, by 2042, white Americans will lose their majority status. And so here we do have these growing whitetopias that are predominantly, even extremely white.
And in part, it's that search for that mythical 1950s neighborhood to live next door to the Cleavers.
Yes, it is. There's a lot of nostalgia. I think one of the most poignant comments I remember interviewing someone in one of these communities is her telling me about her childhood in California during the 1950s. And she says, quote, you know, California was a little paradise.
You and I moved here, Sonari, both of us, from another little paradise, which was Chicago.
Yes, we did.
And when you moved here, you said to me that you thought that you would never be able to enjoy something that we had in Chicago.
Yeah, I was sort of thinking, when I moved here, I thought, you know, the city is too refined. It doesn't have any, like, real guttural culture. And there's this little one place that you can go and see, like, a mixing of people in D.C.
And they have something that Chicago does very well, which is...
hot dogs.
Yes.
A half smoke. Now, I like my half smokes with chili and onions. And one of the best purveyors of the half smoke is Ben's Chili Bowl. And Ben Ali, who is the founder of Ben's Chili Bowl, one of the oldest black restaurants in Washington, passed away this week. NPR's Guy Raz stopped by Ben's Chili Bowl for this tribute to Ben Ali.
If there's one place here in Washington that's always welcomed everyone with a smile and, in a good way, a little heartburn, it's Ben's Chili Bowl. The iconic pink and white facade with the yellow sign is hard to miss on U Street. It's one of the city's oldest and most successful black-owned restaurants. And for 51 years, Ben's has served up a legendary local delicacy, the chili half smoke. It's a spicy beef and pork sausage slathered in chili, onions, and mustard. This past week, Ben Ali, the founder of Ben's Chili Bowl, died at the age of 82.
He was pretty stern, pretty much into his detail about how he wanted his store ran, and he didn't take any mess.
That's Maurice Harcum. He's worked behind the counter at Ben's for more than a decade. The decor here has barely changed since 1958. Photos of Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, and now Barack Obama line the walls. There's even a small sign behind the cash register that reads, "Who eats free at Ben's? Bill Cosby and the Obama family." Everyone else has to pay, and it's cash only. Ben Ali was an immigrant from Trinidad. When he opened the Chili Bowl, U Street was known as America's Black Broadway, a strip of shops and theaters where Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and Nat King Cole played to packed houses. But as Maurice Harcum explains, Ben's is one of the few places on this street that survived and thrived during its ups and downs.
U Street was torn apart after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Everything was torn apart except for us. We survived the drug wars. There were shootings and rival gang wars right out front of here, but they never brought it in here.
Longtime regular John Shetfield sits at the counter waiting for his chili half smoke.
I was here during the riot, and during the riot, they touched everybody's place but this place, you know, because Ben always reached out to the ones underprivileged, you know, never said no to nobody that I know.
Today, this neighborhood is once again a center of nightlife in the city. Luxury condos and high-end shops now line the street. And the crowd at Ben's is usually a mixture of regulars, tourists, and revelers ambling by after midnight. Local Anthony Pettaway says they come here to the house Ben Ali built for one simple reason.
the chili bowl spot. You had to get a hot dog. That was the main attraction of coming up U Street, you know. Although the lights, you know, the people were out here, the pimps and all of that. But it was Ben's chili bowl.
It's rumored that Ben Ali never actually tried his famous half smoke. He was a practicing Muslim who observed his faith's prohibition on eating pork. But at least once a month, up until the day he died, you could find Ben Ali standing behind the same lunch counter he made famous.
You know, Netta, I'm in a tribute to Ben Ali, I'm going to go to Ben's chili bowl sober.
You know, when I first started working at NPR, I got off at the Metro right outside of Ben's chili bowl every night, and I was really young. I would work really late, and my girlfriend broke up with me, and I would go to Ben's chili bowl every night, and I'd get a milkshake, and I'd get a half smoke, and I'd just sit there and just kind of reflect on life.
Yeah. Ben's chili bowl lives on. Ben Ali will be missed.
Cue Sea of Heartbreak. Many artists have recorded this song, Sea of Heartbreak, over half a century. This rendition by Roseanne Cash and Bruce Springsteen is on Cash's new album, The List. The album title refers to a list of timeless songs made years ago by her father, Johnny Cash.
I was out on the road with him, and he mentioned a song and while we were riding on the tour bus one day, and I said, I don't know that one. And he mentioned another, and I said, I don't know that one either, Dad. And he got very alarmed. I was so steeped in the Beatles and Buffalo Springfield, and he thought I was missing something essential about my own musical genealogy. So he spent the rest of the day making this list.
Lost love and loneliness, memories of your caress, so divine, how I wish you were mine again, my dear. I'm on this sea of tears, sea of heartbreak.
You mentioned that you think your father might have been affected by collaborating with another musician. And, of course, mm-hmm. you collaborate here not only with your husband, John Leventhal, who produces and plays guitar, mm-hmm. but you also bring in Bruce Springsteen to sing some harmonies.
Yeah, I couldn't find anybody good, so I got Bruce. You know, I wanted to do this song as a duet, and it was John's idea to ask Bruce, and I thought, yeah, maybe there's a 50-50 chance Bruce will do it. He doesn't do that many duets. But he said yes right away. And, of course, he knew the song. He's very steeped in country and roots music. And when John put the vocals together, finally, he said, my God, it's so romantic. And this is my own husband talking.
Sea of heartbreak.
Bruce, who knew he was such a great country crooner?
Oh, what I'd give to sail back to shore, back to your arms once more.
We made this song even more introspective than I think the Don Gibson version.
Did you experiment with different tempos, instrumentations, ways to play this, given that there are so many different versions of it?
Yes. John wrote the arrangement for this, and he actually wrote four different arrangements before we got to this one. And it was just torturing him. And then he went to the studio alone one night to work on it. It was really keeping him up. And he came home, and he said, I've got it. And his face was just lit up.
Come to my rescue. Take me and keep me away from the sea.
What do you think your father might have thought of this version if he'd heard it?
I think my dad would have been so proud. You know, I spent my life as a songwriter, sometimes pushing away this music. And I wish he could see me embrace it so fully.
That's it for this week.
Thank you so much, Netta, for letting me come and muck around in your...
In my mess.
Yes. So you can find all of the links to the stories we've heard today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Sonari Glenton.
We love having you here. I'm Netta Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.